Suffolk County has a database that's supposed to keep track of gang members, but it has a lot of mistakes, and some say that bad data has even led to false arrests. Now, police agencies and elected officials are rethinking what they should do with this information. Plus, between housing kids in school, daily expenses can cost a lot of money. The co-host of WNYC's Nancy podcast joins us to talk about how life gets even more expensive for LGBTQ people.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up this hour, we speak with Tobin Lowe, host of the Nancy podcast, about their new series, Queer Money Matters. The five-part series explores different financial hurdles faced by the LGBTQ community. And we talk about a new documentary from Illinois Youth Media that dives into the complicated history and modern-day misconceptions around affirmative action when it comes to colleges. But first, for years, law enforcement agencies in Chicago have used gang databases with tens of thousands of names that can be accessed by more than 350 government agencies. But these databases have been riddled with mistakes for a long time, such as including people who are supposedly more than 100 years old. There have also been lawsuits filed by people who say this information has led to false arrests that disproportionately affect communities of color. ProPublica Illinois' Mick Dumke first reported on this last year, and as more and more information about these databases has come out, changes are actually happening. Not only has Cook County Sheriff Tom Dart decided to stop using the database, county commissioners have now approved a law that would require county data to be destroyed altogether. I spoke with Mick earlier, and I started by asking him how long we've had these gang databases.
They've been around for decades. The Chicago Police Department has people going back to the 80s, and my understanding is they were tracking information about people's purported gang ties well before that, too. But the current incarnation goes back at least several decades, and there's a legitimate law enforcement reason for it, at least at the beginning, which is to try to keep track of what's going on with gang activity in Chicago, which is a real problem. Don't want to diminish that while we're talking about some of the questions about these gang databases and some of the civil rights issues that surround them. But at heart, they at least started, as I'm told, because police were trying to keep track of gang members and gang activity that often leads to violence.
Mick, is part of the problem that even the way we understand how gangs work, especially when it comes to Chicago, is not maybe how we think they work? Like, we tend to think that, like, a gang is like an organized group that has a leader and has this amount of many people in it, and that's the gang. And is that really how gangs work in Chicago these days?
My understanding is that they do not work like that by and large anymore. There's very highly structured gangs that you used to hear about in the 80s and 90s, by and large, are a thing of the past. You hear a lot more about factions. You hear a lot more about people organizing around a certain block. And a lot of the disputes and a lot of the violence that ends up erupting ends up being more interpersonal than necessarily a big gang against gang kind of war. Those kind of conflicts do happen, as I understand from law enforcement officials. There are still gangs battling other gangs, but a lot of this seems to be very interpersonal, with the gangs very fragmented, even down to the block level or parts of blocks in some instances. But that said, police and the sheriff's office said they still need to keep track of people's alliances. A lot is happening on the street. Obviously, the violence in Chicago has made national news. And the police are under extraordinary pressure to do something about it and do something about it quickly. So that's one of the reasons why we get these kinds of secret databases. And I say they're secret. Obviously, we're talking about it, so it's not a complete secret. But there are so many questions about how they're put together, how people get on the list, whether there's any chance for them ever to get off the list. And outside of law enforcement, it's very difficult to get any kind of a glimpse of these gang databases and other kinds of databases that law enforcement maintains on people.
And so, Mick, to that point, first of all, do we know how many names are in these databases? We don't know how people end up in them?
Well, we do in some instances. Let me go back and answer your first question. I got a glimpse of some of these databases last year. As you mentioned, I started doing some reporting. I engaged in some freedom of information battles with the Chicago Police Department and a couple other state agencies and local agencies, and eventually got a partial copy of Chicago's gang database. They basically gave me a big spreadsheet with entries in their database with personal identification removed. But what I did find is that they, at that time, had more than 100,000 people in this database. And I found that it was had all kinds of errors in it. There were people, as you mentioned, who were in their hundreds. There were dozens of people who were supposedly senior citizens who they still listed as gang members. And I'm not saying there couldn't ever be someone who is in his 70s who is still affiliated with a gang, but to have dozens of them, it seemed a little bit unlikely. There were also gangs listed in there that, as I understand, haven't existed for decades. And you could go on and on. And so these kinds of errors or these kinds of illogical entries raise questions about how accurate the rest of it is. And your other question was about what do we know about how people got in here? Well, we've had some anecdotal evidence emerge when people have gotten, for instance, caught up in immigration proceedings. There have been a couple of cases of this in Chicago where federal immigration officials went after someone because they said he was a gang member based on information they got out of this database. And it turned out in at least one of these instances that the person was entered into there after he was involved in a traffic stop with police. And he said he was put in there just because of where he lived, not because he was ever in a gang, which he said he wasn't. So I can tell, Nyla, from looking at this information, that it's not just people who have been arrested or charged or convicted of crimes. There are also people in this database who appear to have been put in there by police officers who just stopped and interviewed them on the street, you know, a stop and frisk kind of situation, and they ended up in the database. So it appears that there's all sorts of different ways you could end up on one of these lists.
And so, obviously, when it comes to things like stop and frisk, we've seen some very clear legal challenges to that. And I wonder, when we think about this database, legally, who's responsible for maintaining it?
Well, there are different databases. Just to be clear, first of all, the Chicago Police has its own. The database you alluded to earlier that Cook County maintains is called the Regional Gang Intelligence Database. The state police has one. I'm aware that the Illinois Department of Corrections has their own. And there are also databases maintained across the country by other law enforcement agencies. So there's a lot of these. I think one of the big issues surrounding them is who has access to them. In addition to the members of those particular agencies, who else on the outside has access to it? I just talked about ICE, Federal Immigration and Customs Enforcement. They have had access to the Chicago Police Gang Database. There are other law enforcement agencies. I think there are more than 370 who had access to the regional gang database that the Cook County Sheriff's Office maintained. And when I got a list of agencies that had access to the state police, they included some private agencies, some police departments at private universities who had access to this information. And while they, you know, are going to argue they have a law enforcement purpose for getting this information, again, these are public agencies maintaining databases where the rules aren't always clear how people are entered in. Their labels are affixed to them. And then you have people who are employed by private organizations who potentially have access to it. I think that raises a whole series of civil rights questions.
My guest is ProPublica Illinois's Mick Dumke, and we're talking about the reporting he's been doing about various gang databases throughout the Chicagoland area. And so, Mick, recently the Cook County Board voted to ban this regional database that was run by the Cook County Sheriff's Office. So what in practice does that mean?
Well, the regional gang database that Cook County Sheriff's Office maintained had more than 25,000 names on it. And after I wrote about it, a couple of Cook County commissioners sort of took aim at it and started negotiations with the sheriff's department. And as you mentioned, it resulted in the full board voting to essentially ban the use of this particular database. The sheriff's office also is not allowed anymore to provide information to other databases, including, for instance, Chicago's or the state police database. And I think what's also very important is within the next couple of months, the sheriff's office is required to participate in public hearings that will, in theory at least, get into some of the origins of the database, how it was used, how people were put in there, and whether there's any possibility of notifying the people who were put in there. Because at this point in time, unless you just happen upon the information, if you were entered into one of these databases, you probably don't know about it. So it's a pretty significant step in this movement from a lot of community groups and civil rights advocates to limit or reform or eliminate altogether these kinds of databases. The fact that Cook County took this step, I think it's a pretty big deal in the broader conversation. I'm not aware of any other major law enforcement agencies around the country that have taken a step like this.
Mick, this is just one part. This is a significant step, but it's also one part of this broader conversation because this isn't the only database out there, and we really don't know how accurate, whether we're talking about the city of Chicago or the state of Illinois, these other databases, if they have similar problems, right?
That is correct. That is correct. And there is a movement around here. There's a hashtag, erase the database. Activists want to get rid of all these kinds of databases. At the state level, State Senator Patricia Van Pelt has introduced legislation that will result, that is going to result in a report that's supposed to be issued by state law enforcement agencies, I think within the next 6 months. The deadline ended up getting extended because of, among other things, the changeover in administrations, the governor's office. But basically, within the first half of this year, there's supposed to be a report issued about some of the state agencies' maintenance of these kinds of databases. So you're exactly right, Nyla, that the Cook County one is just one. It's not even the biggest one around here. But the fact that there was movement on that one, I think, has really heartened a lot of advocates for reining in these systems.
And Mick, has this become an issue in the mayoral race in Chicago? Are we hearing candidates Lori Lightfoot and Tony Preckwinkle discussing this?
Absolutely. I think almost all of the candidates in the first round for mayor vowed various kinds of criminal justice reforms and police accountability, and the gang database came up. And I believe both Lori Lightfoot and Tony Preckwinkle have vowed to either get rid of the database or make significant changes to it to sort of limit the scope and the potential damage from it.
And so we will see how this plays out within the city of Chicago. But for right now, it seems like Cook County may be setting a trend or maybe changing, I guess, the way that we look at this for not just for the Chicagoland area, for Illinois, but for the whole country.
That's certainly what the advocates and activists who worked on this issue are hoping for. There was a lot of attention to what happened in Cook County last week. And I should note that the Chicago Police Department, even a year ago when I started reporting on this, vowed that it would make changes to the way it uses and compiles its own database. For instance, a police official said they would come up with a way that people on their database would have a right to the ability to basically challenge the information and to have it amended if it was wrong. But I keep bugging them about it. I don't think anything has been put into writing yet, or at least not finalized. So we're still waiting to hear what CPD has planned. And as you mentioned, Nyla, the mayoral candidates are vowing that they're going to take action on this when they get into office. Now, with the number of things that they promised to take action on, I'm not sure this will be the first thing they get to, but certainly it seems like there is some momentum for at least bringing some more daylight to these kinds of databases.
And Mick, what are the police saying about this? Whether it's, I mean, we have a clear message from Cook County Sheriff's Office, but you're talking about CPD or we're thinking about ISP. I mean, what are we hearing from law enforcement agencies about how they feel like they can balance their need to clearly be tracking violent people in our society and make sure that they are not committing crimes with civil rights issues?
Well, I think the main thing that's happening is they're acknowledging that this is an issue, that this is a discussion that's happening, and they have an interest in being part of the conversation and trying to take a lead in coming up with solutions so that they're not left behind and so that people aren't legislating around them, essentially. Because as you mentioned, Nyla, a lot of law enforcement officials will make the point that they have to keep track of people who are involved in organized crime and other kinds of criminal activity. So, if we were talking about mobsters and the FBI was doing it, most people wouldn't have really a complaint about that. I think the issue is, has this become a proxy for young men of color? And when we say gang affiliation, especially when everything is so fragmented and where there's such strong neighborhood associations with gang activity, that there's a real concern that people are getting in there just based on where they live and what they look like. So that's out there. The law enforcement agencies are aware of it. They know that some of these databases, the standards have been pretty loose, that there are errors in there. They acknowledge these points when I had reported about it. So they're promising to do better, but they don't want to get rid of the possibility of keeping track of people who are in gangs altogether. I mean, even the sheriff's office is not going to be compelled to stop tracking people who are admitted to the Cook County Jail. They will still try to get people's gang affiliations when they go through a screening process, when people are first brought into the jail. And they say they have to do that for the safety of people who are incarcerated and the safety of staff at the jail, because they don't want to house rivals from one faction or another in the same wing. So they've been collecting that kind of information for years. They're not going to be forced to stop under the law that was just passed. And they say that that is really important that they don't. But yet, at the same time, as we've mentioned, they acknowledge that some of the broader collections, we've been just scooping up all kinds of data, and it's entered in from all different sources. They admit that they need to sort of rein that in a little bit.
That's Mick Dumke. He's a reporter with ProPublica Illinois. We'll tweet out Mick's most recent reporting on this. Thanks for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for the time, Nyla. I appreciate you being interested.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thinking about money can be stressful for many of us, whether it's figuring out how we're ever going to be able to take that vacation, pay rent, or retire. For most of us, thinking about money comes with a lot of anxiety. But if you're in the LGBT community, those conversations become even more complicated. A new poll finds that half of LGBT adults associate money with anxiety. That's 10% higher than straight cisgender people. That data is from a new survey released by the Nancy podcast and the research firm Morning Consult. It explores the financial challenges faced by the queer community. Nancy is also releasing 5 new podcast episodes this week in a new series called Queer Money Matters. So far, they've explored how having children or facing discrimination in the workplace can affect LGBT people financially. Today's episode tackles marriage. For more on what they've covered and what's to come, we're joined by Tobin Lowe, who, along with Kathy Tu, is one of the hosts of the Nancy podcast. Tobin's on the line with us from WNYC in New York. Hey, Tobin, thanks for being here. Welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, Tobin, I wonder if we can start with something, if you can just help us understand a little bit more about when you say queer, what that definition means to you.
You know, the word queer, it has a long history and it means a lot of different things to different people. I would say when we use it on Nancy, we use it as sort of a shorthand to cover anyone who feels part of the LGBTQIA+ community. So it's sort of a shorthand that we use to say that we're all sort of in this community and sort of fighting for a lot of the same things.
And so just to make sure we're all on the same page and understand what we're talking about, when we say cisgender, what do we mean by that?
So cisgender refers to somebody whose sense of their gender identity matches the sex that they were assigned at birth.
I wanted to just ask you, I alluded to this a moment ago, I think talking about money openly is something a lot of us struggle with, not just people who are in the queer community. And I wonder if that's part of why you wanted to do this series?
This all started with a coworker of ours who's in his 60s and has shared with us before that he is HIV positive and had lived through the AIDS crisis in New York in the 80s and 90s, and he actually was on the show talking about it. And he just offhand was sort of like, you know, when I started thinking about retirement, which is a concept I had never really considered for myself before, the first time I talked to a financial planner, that person was like, well, if you have a wife, this means this for your retirement. If you have kids, this is what that means for your retirement. And he was like, that these things weren't even an option for me until very recently. And he was just trying to say that out loud, that he as a queer person had to think about finances differently. And that really intrigued us. And so we really wanted to pull that apart and say, well, if we just started talking about this more, what are the things that queer people face financially that are different than, say, a straight cisgender person?
And so that's what you also point out in the first episode, that our economy is actually built for people who are heterosexual or cisgender. Can you explain a little bit more about what you mean by that? It makes sense. The financial planner example, I think, is just one kind of foray into this, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think the most simple example I can point to, and I talk a little bit about this in our first episode that we dropped, but, you know, there was a point where I looked around at my straight cisgender friends who were getting married and then having kids and then buying houses. And there was sort of this thing where, you know, if you look at taxes or if you look at even just as simple as like a wedding shower where you, you know, can get a boost of, you know, the things that help you set up a home. From the big examples to the small examples, there are ways in which a sort of cisgender straight life comes with little financial bumps along the way that help you into the next step. And I don't mean to say that anything financial is easy for anyone, but I think it was a moment of, it is different for queer people. And how does that translate into their finances?
And you guys did this survey, and one of the things that really struck me was that 35% of queer people said that they could rely on family and friends for financial support before coming out, but that decreases to just 20% after coming out. And I wonder how much that's also an example of something that maybe straight people might not think about as much.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. We broke down the series into a couple different life goals, including getting health care and getting married and having kids. And it was interesting, at least anecdotally, how much people who we spoke to would point back to perhaps a moment where their family was not accepting as sort of the beginning of their financial troubles. If you get kicked out of the house or if your parents, you know, I'm thinking of, for example, we have a healthcare episode coming out later this week. And we spoke to a trans person who was hoping to be able to use their parents' health care to cover their transition costs. And their parents actually threatened to cut them off from their health care if they were to use it to cover their surgeries. So there's a very concrete example of somebody who then had to figure out financially how they were going to cover, you know, very important surgeries without the help of their family. And that's a way in which that statistic you talked about with, you know, people losing the support of their families, again, translates to a financial hardship.
And so how did you all do this? How did you do the survey? Do you mind just letting us into that?
Yeah, so we worked with Morning Consult, which basically is a survey company, and they polled a certain number of people who identified as straight and cisgender, and then a certain representative panel of folks who identified as LGBTQ. And they answered questions about how they felt about their finances, what words came up. We specifically asked about anxiety and depression when asked about your personal finances. We asked questions about if you intended to have kids and how you thought about the ways that you would have kids. So it was sort of a wide array of things to do with people's finances.
And how much research is there like this out there?
You know, it's interesting. We started to think about doing this project and we started poking around, and the answer is not much. And I don't know why that is, but in terms of really looking at queer people's finances, at least for us, we couldn't find very much. We did get to speak to a researcher named Lee Badgett, who's done work in breaking down the myth of gay affluence, which is this idea that perhaps gay people have more money because they tend to not have kids or things like that. And actually, her research has found that that's not the truth, and that the discrimination in the workplace really sort of counteracts a lot of the things you might assume would put gay people in a financial benefit.
Yeah, I wondered about that. I was just listening to that episode. And where do you think this idea that we comes from our head, where we the whole idea of gay affluence, where we tend to think that gay people, I think there is an image people have in their head of two white, well-educated men without children who are making a lot of money?
I think part of it is something that Lee also points to, which is that a lot of the gay and queer people who we see in the public eye are that image that you just described. So there are a lot of gay, you know, cisgender, male, white celebrities who we can think of, and they tend to be pushed forward as sort of an image of living a fabulous life, getting to travel, you know, getting to be fabulous. So I think that is part of the mental image we have when somebody brings up, well, what do you think the financial picture is like for queer people?
My guest is Tobin Low. He's one of the co-hosts of the Nancy podcast, and we're talking about a series that they have released. So there's a new episode every day this week. It's called Queer Money Matters. And Tobin, you were just saying how you basically took different life events. And mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you about Monday's episode because it's the whole idea of kids. Right. And in the survey, you found that although that more than half of LGBT couples say they don't have kids, 41% of those who didn't have kids said they really wanted them. That's compares to 37% so of straight people. So more people in the queer community are saying that they don't have kids and want to have kids. And I wonder how much you think, what accounts for that disparity and how much money plays a role in that?
I don't know if I can answer what exactly accounts for the disparity, but I think the part that we examine in the episode about money and what that comes into play is that if a couple can't go the quote-unquote traditional route of having kids, any other option is incredibly expensive. And that ranges from fostering to adopt, which is on the cheaper end, which still can cost a couple thousand dollars, up to if you're looking into surrogacy or IVF, that can range up into the hundreds of thousands of dollars. And so we were really interested in examining how queer people from the jump, a lot of them have to go a very financially expensive route. And how does that play out and how they think about having kids?
And one of your listeners was Jessie Perret. She and her wife spent between $25,000 to $30,000 trying to conceive. Let's take a little listen to this clip about Jessie talking about this.
When I look at my daughter, I definitely am so, so thrilled to have a child and to be raising an amazing little human with another amazing human, which is my wife. But the cost has definitely impacted how we raise her. The cost has definitely impacted our decision not to have a second child, which I would have loved to have had. The cost of having her has really changed the trajectory of our financial past. You know, our financial security is a little more unstable because of the cost of our modern family.
That's Jessie Perret on the Nancy podcast. Co-host Tobin Low is with us. Tobin, you got a lot of feedback on this topic and played a lot of recordings from your listeners. Was there anything really surprising about what you heard?
I think what surprised me or perhaps really stuck out to me about the responses is how much the queer couples who are exploring their options also have to account for the emotional cost of figuring out which route they're going to go. We spoke to another couple in the episode named Alana and Claire, and part of it was they had a savings plan set out for themselves to do IVF. But there was also a lot of discussion about, well, how many attempts can we emotionally take before this feels like it's not just a financial burden, but an emotional burden. But it was so important to them also to go the route of conceiving. And so there was sort of this weighing of emotional versus financial costs of how they wanted to go about having a kid. And that was something that really stuck out to me in this nuance of the conversations that queer couples are having.
I'm sure that lots of folks can identify with all of those costs that you're talking about.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about another episode. On Tuesday, you talked about the workplace and discrimination people can face in the workplace. And I wanted to just play another clip of, this is Josiah, who's transgender. Here's what he had to say about his experience.
I kind of fulfilled my duties as an American person. You know, you go to school for 13 years, you get that high school diploma, and then you go to college for 4, and then you're expected to go and you get a great job and you'll be able to live great, except for the fact that I'm trans. So society kind of says we don't count.
That's Josiah on the Nancy podcast. Tobin, so I think it's about 1 in 5 LGBTQ people say they experience discrimination in their workplace, but that number goes up to 30% when we're talking about transgender workers. I wonder, mm-hmm. when we're thinking about that, what else you heard about the experience of job searching, being transgender, and that's a very real financial cost, whether or not you can find a job.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would point to another thing that Josiah says later in the episode where, you know, he had really had to weigh not just could he get a job, but then also really doing the research of would the potential jobs that are being offered to me be accepting. And so for him, he made the personal choice to take a job at Starbucks, which was a really accepting environment, but he's also very realistic that he's accepting a lower paying job for that acceptance. So I think that's a thing that we have heard from queer people, again, that weighing of emotional cost versus financial cost. You know, do I want to have to put up with harassment or an insensitive workplace if it means that I feel more solid, or do I need to prioritize one over the other?
So, Tobin, when we're looking at all of these issues, when we're thinking about all of these big life moments, children, jobs, marriage, I wonder, today's episode actually tackles marriage, and I think it might be easy for a lot of people to assume that after gay marriage or same-sex marriage was legalized back in 2015, a lot of those problems disappeared. In mm-hmm. this episode, you guys confront the fact that's not really the case, right?
Yeah, and it's interesting that assumption that you're talking about, at least anecdotally, we heard from a couple people who worked at companies that were, before the passage of same-sex marriage, interested in exploring the different options for providing benefits for partners and domestic partnership. And then when same-sex marriage got passed into the law of the land, those companies being like, well, you got same-sex marriage now, so we must not have to offer those other options. And so actually the coverage becoming a little bit less diverse and a little bit less accessible. And what we get into the episode is that there's a lot of queer people who really feel like marriage is not part of their queer identity. And so what does that cost them financially if they don't see themselves getting married and then therefore getting the access to the benefits that come with that?
I wondered if, I mean, a lot of these, when you look at, especially when I was looking through the survey, a lot of the statistics are pretty disheartening and they're kind of sad, and they're not kind of, they are sad. I wonder, there were other parts of this, though, that are maybe give you hope or are very uplifting. And I wonder what of those things stick with you as you guys have been reporting this series out.
You know, honestly, the thing that makes me feel the most heartened about working on this series is the second we sort of pitched this idea to people. We have a private Facebook group where we reach out to listeners sometimes with, you know, story ideas or topics we're interested in covering. And we posited this idea to them that, do you feel like the economy is not built for you as a queer person? And even just the naming of that out loud, there were so many people who started sharing their stories, and the sigh of relief in sharing those stories was so, it was so real. And so I think if there's anything that gives me hope in working on this series, it's just that people feel like they can finally talk about a thing that they've been privately living with, but hasn't been widely acknowledged. And so I think that's like what the real power is. And, you know, you talked before about finances being scary. I think that's the power in sharing some information about how we think about our finances and what our money profile looks like.
As you're thinking about these stories, I'm sure lots of things came up. I wonder what else we have to look forward to hearing from you guys about this week.
Yeah, so later this week, we have episodes coming out about healthcare. In that one, we specifically focus on transgender patients and sort of the lengths that they often have to go to, even to just get basic primary healthcare. And then also, as promised, the episode about retirement, where we speak with David, our coworker, about thinking about retirement as an older queer person. What does that look like? What are the options? So I think it's really interesting stuff coming up.
You can get that wherever you get your podcast, WNYC Studios' Nancy podcast. I want to thank co-host Tobin Lowe for being with us. Hey, Tobin, thanks for taking the time to speak with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.
You do not take a person who for years has been hobbled by chains and liberate him, bringing up to the starting line of a race, and then say you are free to compete with all the others, and still justly believe that you have been completely fair. Thus, it is not enough just to open the gates of opportunity. All our citizens must have the ability to walk through those gates.
That's President Lyndon B. Johnson speaking at Howard University's 1965 commencement address. That speech came during the heart of the tumultuous 1960s, a decade that brought about massive cultural and legal changes. The 1960s is also when LBJ used the term affirmative action in a 1965 executive order. Now, a new oral history project from Illinois Youth Media is tackling the topic of affirmative action, both its complex history and modern-day implications. The project is called Beyond Opening the Gates, and you can stream it online now. We'll have the link up at our website, 21stshow.org. This coming Monday at 4 o'clock, the team behind this project is hosting an event, if you're in the Central Illinois area, at the U of I's College of Education, to talk more about affirmative action and what it means for all of us today. In the meantime, I'm joined on the line now by Catherine Delarude, who's a graduate of the University Laboratory High School in Urbana and the producer of Beyond Opening the Gates. Nowadays, she's a freshman at the University of Southern California. Catherine, thanks for joining us. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi, thank you so much for having me on.
Also joining me here in studio in Urbana is Rochelle Gutierrez, who shared her experiences in the documentary. Rochelle Gutierrez is a professor of curriculum and instruction in the Department of Education at the University of Illinois. Professor Gutierrez, thanks for being with us as well.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And Catherine, I wanted to start with you in that clip that we heard of Lyndon Johnson speaking to the crowd at the 1965 Howard University commencement. Is that where you got the title for this documentary, I assume?
Yes, it is. As you heard, he talks about in the speech how it's not enough to just open the gates of opportunity. Everyone has to have the ability to walk through them. And we toyed with the idea of having the name like walking through the gate, but we thought that sounded a little bit weird, and we eventually settled on Beyond Opening the Gate, kind of in recognition of how much work there still is to do.
And when we think about that work, Professor Gutierrez, affirmative action, I think, is a term that many people see as a loaded term. There are a lot of misconceptions around it. And I wondered if we could just start with what you think are some of the most common misconceptions when it comes to affirmative action and we think about universities and higher education.
I think one of the misconceptions is that this is all about lowering standards and having quotas and having people that get in, and that this is kind of one directional, that we're allowing these people who don't have the qualifications that we would normally expect from people we would enter in the University of Illinois, for example, and we let those people in, and those people accrue those benefits. But it's really a two-way street. It really is, you know, that the University of Illinois also benefits from having those people in those spaces because they'll ask different questions, they're going to have different conversations, and they're actually in some ways going to demand that the university respond to them, and that actually changes the university. So it's really a two-way street. It's not kind of a one-sided thing. I think that we don't think about the kind of ongoing labor that happens with people who are parts of these affirmative action programs. So, for example, students who come to the University of Illinois who come under an affirmative action program, they end up serving as kind of a walking curriculum for other students on the university campus. And so, we refer to them as kind of unpaid Sherpas in many classes where university courses are trying to address issues of race and class and all these other kinds of dimensions. And these people end up having to be, you know, educators for their colleagues. They're sitting in their dorms and they're having long conversations, educating each other about their home experiences and things like that. And that's a kind of labor that we don't notice and we don't pay for as a university. So again, we make it seem as if this is kind of a one-way street and that they're the beneficiaries, but it's really the University of Illinois that's also a beneficiary, and we need to be thinking about that as well.
And how do you think these misconceptions harm the purpose of programs? Certainly, if there's a conception that people who are there don't deserve to be there, that's obviously going to put people on different footing from the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, I think people treat you differently. I mean, I think people identify you as, oh, you must be here because of that special program. And because you're here with this special program, you don't really deserve to be here. So, and you might not even be here tomorrow because maybe because you weren't good enough, you won't last. So I think there's a sense of you know, people constantly questioning your space to be there and maybe even kind of writing off, and I'm not even sure this person will be here tomorrow. So it's not really worth my time to invest in having a relationship with this person or learning from this person.
Catherine, I wonder if we could pull, I wanted to just play a little bit of one of the folks that you spoke with. Jamie Singson is the former director of the Native American House at the University of Illinois. And I thought he had an interesting take on what affirmative action means in terms of representation.
We are a land-grant institution. So a land-grant institution says you are an institution that's for all of the people in Illinois. And so if you look at what the demographic is of Illinois, we know the different percentages, that there's this many, 52% white, on down through the different categories, that those percentages, as we do the census for Illinois, you would think that the University of Illinois should represent, as a land-grant institution, those demographics. From an affirmative action standpoint, you could say, well, why, if Native American population is 2% in Illinois, why is it 0.02%? at the University of Illinois? That's where I think one aspect of affirmative action has an ability to say you should be striving for what your population represents.
That's Jamie Singson, former director of the Native American House at the University of Illinois, speaking to Illinois Youth Media in the documentary Beyond Opening the Gates. We're talking to one of the producers behind it, as well as one of the other folks that were in the documentary, Professor Rochelle Gutierrez. First, can I just ask, Professor Gutierrez, would you agree with how he described affirmative action there?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's something very wrong with a university that's a land-grant university that doesn't represent the state of Illinois. I mean, if this place is supposed to be representative of the people, and I think it's not just that we care about what numbers of those people are there, but like, how is the university serving those people? It's not just about opening spaces for them to be at the institution, but in what way is the curriculum actually providing a window or a mirror for them about their own experiences, about learning about their lives and their histories and problems that they want to solve in their community, and not just, we allow you to be in this place because we want to count numbers and we want to look good publicly to the state. But it's really about what's the responsibility to attend to the needs of the state of Illinois and all of its representatives.
Catherine, what did you all find in the documentary when we think about what the student population and the faculty population of the U of I looks like compared to Illinois' demographics?
As Jamie Simpson said, many of the demographics of the University of Illinois don't match the demographics of the state. I think that, like Dr. Gutierrez said, there's something really wrong with the state if the people at its biggest university aren't matching the population of the state. We need to be addressing those issues within the university and asking kind of why are we not representing the state well.
I do wonder, when we think about misconceptions around affirmative action, and we think that, when we tend to think that it's about quotas, I think it's hard, it gets a little muddied when we think about numbers and representation. And Professor Gutierrez, I wonder how we can reconcile that of thinking about we want to be representative and reflect the correct demographic picture of what we look like, but at the same time, it's not about quotas.
So part of it is you have to start with the fact that within any group, you're going to have variability. So there's not some kind of a natural state or hierarchy of like white people are more intellectual or are more academic than other kind of people. That's not the case. So when you've got something like that, that variance is now seen to be a normal thing that like, well, of course you'd have all whites at an institution. Of course they're smarter. Of course you're going to have Asians. Of course you're going to, and you reinscribe that idea. I think first of all, there's something really wrong with that. I think that in terms of why that representation might look different, I mean, we could even argue that we don't even want equal representation right now, that if we're going to actually make reparations for the generations of people who have accumulated wealth through academics like the University of Illinois, who have the alumni relations, who have the doctorates, or who have the degrees from this institution, that we actually want to be increasing and trying to get more people who have been historically oppressed or who have not been represented at the university to up those numbers to redress those past injustices. I think it's one thing to say we want to be representative of the state, but I'm not sure that actually makes up for what has historically happened in this state of Illinois. and the United States.
Well, and then to even get to that point, though, even to get to the point of representing the state, a lot of this does come down to thinking about the admissions process, the recruiting process. And I wanted to play another part of the documentary. This is from Kevin Pitts, Vice Provost for Undergraduate Education at the U of I, talking about how the admissions process works at the university.
We're looking at not only how a student has done in high school and what they've achieved, but we try to compare it to what opportunities they've had. Because some students have had lots and lots of opportunities to do all kinds of great things when they're in high school, and some students didn't. And so it's not really fair to kind of judge them all by exactly the same standard, because some students didn't have a chance. And so by kind of being more, we use the term holistic, but being more thoughtful about comparing achievement to opportunity, that's one way that we provide opportunities for students from diverse backgrounds.
Again, that's Kevin Pitts, Vice Provost for Undergraduate Education at the University of Illinois, in the documentary Beyond Opening the Gates. Professor Gutierrez, is that how the admissions process works? Like, it is really about looking at people's individual stories?
You know, I actually have to question that, because my son is a junior now in mechanical engineering here at this university, and I was absolutely shocked that the University of Illinois does not look at teacher recommendations. It looks at test scores. It looks at grade point average. And then if you want to apply to the James Scholar Program or to some of these other extra programs, that's when anything around a kind of essay where you're trying to argue something about yourself and what you might contribute to the field comes into play. I'm not sure. Maybe it's different for engineering than other kinds of fields. But I think the fact that we continue to rely on these quantitative measures, I mean, my background's in mathematics, and those numbers are not objective numbers. I mean, what score you get on the SAT or on the ACT is often a reflection of, did your family have enough money to send you to tutoring so that you can get special SAT prep skills or so that you can do these kinds of things? So I think, I don't know, maybe there's some new initiatives that are being started at the University of Illinois that are these more holistic measures.
Catherine, I wonder if you could we're almost out of time, but I just wanted to ask you one last question about what you learned most about doing this documentary and when it comes to affirmative action in the University of Illinois. What was your big takeaway from this?
So I definitely learned a lot about the documentary, but I think that one of the biggest things I learned is that affirmative action is not just an admissions-based process. And I think this is a really, really common misconception. It's a huge effort to create a diverse environment coordinated by a number of offices, the administration, like the cultural centers, and even more than just that, to recruit students to actually even apply to the University of Illinois. And then once they get here, making sure that they graduate, because we discussed this a little bit in our documentary. At no fault of their own, do a lot of students of color have lower graduation rates than white students. And I think that this is a reflection on the university, and they're trying to increase the number of programs to get students to stay and to help them and to make the environment more inclusive. Affirmative action is not just an admissions-based process.
You have an event coming up at the College of Education that's going to be talking more about this, Catherine?
Yes. So actually, Dr. Gutierrez is going to serve on the panel. So the event is Monday, March 11th from 4 to 5, and we're hoping to focus questions on the future of affirmative action and diversity and inclusion measures, because we didn't get to talk about it quite as much in the documentary, but it is a really important thing to talk about. Where is affirmative action going, especially in the current political climate, and what can we do to make sure that it continues?
We'll have the information about that at our website, 21stshow.org, as well as this documentary. You can listen to it. It's available online. Go to 21stshow.org for more information. I want to thank Professor Rochelle Gutierrez for being with us. She teaches in the Department of Curriculum and Instruction at the University of Illinois, and producer of Beyond Opening the Gates documentary, former Uni High student Catherine Delarude. Both of you, thanks for being with me.
It's a pleasure. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Before we go today, breaking news this hour out of Chicago for former Congressman Aaron Schock. In a surprise move, prosecutors have agreed to drop corruption charges against the Peoria Republican, providing he pays back the money he owes to the IRS and his congressional campaign fund. We've seen some reports this morning he's also been levied a $25,000 fine. This morning was supposed to be a routine hearing before Schock went to trial in June. In 2016, he was indicted on 24 counts, including fraud and theft of government funds. Now, in what's known as a, quote, deferred prosecution agreement, it looks like all of those charges will be dropped. Schock was once a rising star in the Republican Party, representing Illinois' 18th congressional district, which includes Peoria, Springfield, and Bloomington, before he resigned in 2015. Stay tuned to this NPR station today for more on this breaking story, and we'll have more on this on tomorrow's program. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. You can always head to our website, 21stshow.org, for more information. We are a production of Illinois Public Media, and I'll see you tomorrow.